Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. Welcome back to the Early Morning Sunday Show. And as I mentioned, it is the time for our conscious consumer. But we don't have Mufti with us this morning. However, he's been kind enough to record his the answers to the questions that I have posed to him. So one of the things that I did ask was about the 13 check. What is it and how can it be optimally used? And this is what Mufti had to say.
A 13th check is basically a bonus payment at the end of the year that an employee receives. By virtue of being a bonus payment, it obviously means that a 13th check is an amount of money or sum of money that is received over and above the monthly allocation to a particular employee. So that is basically a simple definition of what a 13th check is. I must add and state very clearly at the outset that a 13th check from a Sharia standpoint is more a privilege than a right of the employee. I say this because there tends to be a misunderstanding among many individuals when it comes to labor disputes. When you find individuals claiming that I used to get a 13th check and now my employee suddenly stopped it without any explanation. And the employee, you find in some cases, is demanding an explanation of some sort in terms of why that 13th check is not being allocated. So it is important to keep in mind that a 13th check is a privilege and rather than a right of the individual employee. That goes as far as a definition of what a 13th check is. In the next few minutes, I think what would help is maybe to outline a few things that people can do so that a 13th check is put to optimal use. These are just a few that I can think of, and I'm sure they are. The list is basically endless in terms of what can be done with a 13th check and how it can be used optimally. The first thing I would suggest is for individuals who do receive a 13th check to give themselves the best present ever this season by taking care of some of their debt load when it comes to managing their finances. So it is worthwhile considering utilizing that 13th check towards shedding some of your debt that you may be carrying for some time, or even irrespective of how long it's been carried, it will pay to utilize that surplus sum of money towards shedding some of your debt. If I just use a simple example, and I'm not endorsing interest in any way, but if you think of an individual who may be paying off a home loan worth about R1 million, let's say it's being paid off over 20 years, which is the maximum repayment period in home loans. So you're paying off this R1 million over a 20-year period, and let's assume that the prevailing interest rate for that loan is 10%. You'll be surprised that if you just pay a small amount towards that loan, you'll find that you could reduce the amount you actually pay over the longer term so significantly that you could make a huge saving in terms of how much you knock off from that balance. So you'll find that if you could knock off, let's say you put in about a 10,000 rand payment, you make a 10,000 rand payment in the same example of R1 million home loan over 20 years at 10%, you're basically saving more than, say, about 60,000 rand worth in interest. So there's a huge saving when it comes to that specific home loan. Similarly, you'll find in that example I gave you, you're basically reducing your repayment period by almost 7 months, which can be quite significant. And in a period of time, that sum of money could be utilized elsewhere. So you now see that your home loan is settled faster than you actually think or expected it to. So that's one way to shed some of the larger forms of debt which is being carried, and the specific example I'm using is that of a home loan. Obviously, I must add that in the Islamic context, if one is financing a property through Islamic finance, then it will pay to rather utilize that lump sum cash or sum of money towards on the anniversary date, because to pay it any earlier doesn't really benefit the consumer in the way it benefits in the conventional banking system. There's a very deeper reasoning for that, but I'll leave that for another time. But for now, suffice to say that if one is financing property through Islamic finance, then the 13th check or any other lump sum should rather be utilized and targeted towards paying in towards into that loan on the anniversary date rather than on the date of receiving that larger sum of money. So that's the first thing from my side. The second thing that can be done to optimally utilize that 13th check is to consider what schools have to offer in terms of paying your fees early. Many schools offer discounts to parents who pay a year's fees in advance or even a proportion of fees in advance. This can also be a great way to spend one's 13th check. I want to add, while I'm on the topic of schools and utilizing the 13th check towards school fees, I want to highlight the whole practice of utilizing or parents being disingenuous in terms of utilizing their bonuses or their 13th check towards vacations, but at the same time will not think twice of not paying a cent towards school fees or madrasa fees for that matter. So this is indeed a very disingenuous practice. If a person is enjoying the privilege of a 13th check or any other lump sum payment, it should be prioritized and utilized optimally towards rather paying school fees than going for a lavish vacation or any kind of vacation in a circumstance where the parent is intending to default on the child's school fees. There are many other smart ways to spend your bonus. If there are individuals out there, the third suggestion I have is if there are any individuals who have high interest debt like credit cards or even store card accounts, personal loans, those are high interest debts, and as it is, as Muslims, we should not be engaged in any form of interest. But if it does apply to anyone, those store cards especially or credit cards, that may be a worthwhile opportunity, avenue in which a 13th check could be utilized or spent. Those are three suggestions. The fourth one is maybe to consider putting aside that 13th check or bonus into a savings account to provide for maybe maintenance or repairs of a home. Because keep in mind that if you think of an ordinary individual who may be spending money on a monthly basis towards maybe, say, servicing the loan together with maintenance on a property, it can be quite onerous on an ordinary individual to have to settle or on a monthly basis take care of your household budget as well as your refinancing of the your paying off the loan and so much else. So it may help to allocate that 13th check towards maintenance and repairs for now, so that during the year the only obligation that is left is the servicing of the loan itself, if there is a loan being utilized to finance a property. The fifth suggestion I have for utilizing a 13th check optimally is to maybe consider increasing the value of a home by sprucing up some of the exterior features or appearances, maybe like the garden or any other, maybe security features that you'd like to add onto your home. It may be worthwhile spending this sum of money towards these specific features of your home, so that in the event of wanting to sell it, the overall value of the property is increased. So this is how you actually gain. You might not see the gain in rand and cents immediately, but the day you do decide to sell off or dispose of the asset, you find that you're able to gain more due to the overall value of the asset being enhanced and improved. So these are just five things. If I just recap, the first one is to maybe consider putting it towards a home loan, which if anyone happens to be involved in an interest-bearing loan, Allah forbid. The second one is to consider utilizing a 13th check towards settling of school fees or madrasa fees for that matter. The third suggestion is to consider utilizing that surplus funds towards settling high interest debt like maybe credit card or even store cards, Allah forbid. And I sincerely hope that very few people or next to no one is involved in these types of credit. And then the aspect of utilizing your 13th check or any other surplus funds towards maintenance or repairs of a home, so that during the forthcoming year the only obligation is the settling of the financing rather than the financing together with maintenance and repairs. And the fifth one is the aspect of maybe considering enhancing the exterior appearance of a home so that the overall value of the asset is improved. I do understand that many individuals may already have their plans. People who do enjoy the privilege of a 13th check have these plans well in advance. But I've just sufficed on five of the suggestions from my side. In case anyone has not yet thought about them, it is worth considering utilizing this surplus sum of cash and this great privilege which one may accrue in utilizing it in more prudently and more effectively for one's overall personal gain over the long term.
Well, that was the question that we posed, the 13 check. What is it and how can it be optimally used or utilized? And I think Mufti's given us some very good advice, especially if you are one of those people who are fortunate enough to get a 13 check. And I think, you know, even though he mentioned that within Islamic, the realms of Islam, we're not allowed to expect or, you know, it's a bonus, as they would say. Even within, you know, your normal business, if you are getting a 13 check, it is not something that you should take for granted, because depending on how the company performs, a 13 check can actually be not given to you unless it is part of your contract. If it's stipulated in your contract, then only would you be receiving a 13 check. But if the company does not perform well and it is not part of your package, then obviously there's no onus upon them to actually give you a 13 check. The next question that we had was, should indebted consumers be afraid of credit bureaus? So Mufti is going to dispel myths that may take you a long way in understanding how credit bureaus operate and why some of us are afraid of them if you've ever had a run-in with the credit bureau. So let's listen to what he has to say.
There's absolutely no reason for consumers to be afraid of credit bureaus. And as you correctly mentioned, maybe we can put to rest some of those fears of consumers by dispelling some of the myths or even clarifying some of the facts relating to credit bureaus itself. And as I said, I mean, there's absolutely no reason to fear them. It's not some kind of authority that's going to come at midnight and knock on your door and decide to lock you up. So consumers who are or may be indebted should not be afraid in the least for credit bureaus. Yes, the fear element does come in terms of one's credit record being impaired and the credit bureau being able to have access to that information, and by extension, the financial institution having access to that information, and in the process, the ordinary consumer is deprived from accessing any kind of credit or transaction. But be that as it may, I think let's just suffice on responding to your question of dispelling some of the myths that relating to credit bureaus, so that consumers can be put to rest in terms of their fears and anxiety over credit bureaus. The first one I want to mention is that credit bureaus do not use demographics to determine a credit score. Many individuals are under this misconception, and it is a myth that credit bureaus look at your race or your gender in determining whether to grant credit or not. Keep in mind that we live in a country where viewing race or even gender to make a decision or use it as a determining factor in any scenario is against the law. So they do not include information on the number of dependents. As I said, they do not consider your race or even gender in terms of determining whether an individual qualifies for credit or does not qualify for credit. So demographic aspects do not affect or determine one's credit score. This is indeed a myth, and I hope it helps in putting to rest or some of those fears or anxiety regarding the way credit bureaus operate. The second aspect regarding credit bureaus is that they do not know your salary. Many individuals are under the misconception that credit bureaus know your salary, and as a result, they decide whether you will be granted credit or not. This is truly not the case. The credit bureaus are not aware of your salary and do not use it for credit rating. They do not know where you work, or whether you are self-employed, or how much you earn. It has absolutely no bearing on a credit score. A credit provider, however, will use this information to determine affordability, yes. So if you're applying for, let's say, a cell phone contract, and they're checking out your credit history, in that specific scenario, they would use your salary information to determine affordability. Yes, after you've submitted all your documentation, they would use your salary to determine whether you can afford the contract or not. But the credit bureau itself will provide a different kind of information to this credit provider in order to assist in making the decision of whether to proceed with the contract or not. So just to sum it up, the credit bureaus do not know your salary. They do not know where you work, whether you're self-employed, or even how much you earn. That has absolutely no bearing on one's credit score. The third aspect is credit bureaus have a free dispute process available to all consumers. So this is something which many consumers aren't aware of. Keep in mind that, you know, if a person is desperate, let's say you have a consumer whose credit record is impaired and they're trying to get into some further transaction, but a negative or an impaired credit record is standing in the way. Do not fall for a fancy company that claims to clarify and to make everything disappear. Don't fall for that, because the credit bureaus themselves, the legitimate ones within the country, have free dispute processes that can be followed and are accessible to all consumers to utilize. So this particular point goes very far in demonstrating that credit bureaus are not institutions to be feared. Rather, they should consumers should have confidence in them in terms of being an aid towards managing credit, or even making sure that an accurate credit record exists on their side, so that if there are any checks on a particular consumer's credit record, then the green light is basically there to continue. What I would maybe like to do is in the next segment provide some tools and techniques on how to maintain a clean credit record. I know in this year, this is probably going to be the second segment where we're talking about credit records and credit bureaus. Maybe we'll avoid it for the next year and just keep the topic on the back burner for a while. But I do believe we have discussed credit bureaus and managing credit scores to some extent. So we might just consider giving it a break for the year of 2020.
You are listening to the Early Morning Sunday Show here on Radio Islam International. It's just gone at 9:30, and we are at our Conscious Consumer Spot. And as I mentioned earlier, Mufti Muhammad Hafiji from the financial desk of the Jamaatul Ulama is not with us this morning, but he has answered the questions that I have posed to him, and he is. We have the answers for you. So the last question that I asked was: social entrepreneurship is gaining traction globally. Can you break it down for us? So, alhamdulillah, he has done that, and let's listen to him.
You ask a very relevant question, and while it may seem that the question is not related to consumer consciousness, as you'll see from the coming discussion or response, there is a very strong link to consumer behavior in general and consumer consciousness. Let me begin by saying that, or citing a report from Thomson Reuters Foundation's second global poll on the best countries for social entrepreneurs. In this particular survey, they found the survey was about 900 social enterprise experts, and they found that more than half, which is almost 54%, said that the public do not understand what is social entrepreneurship all about. If you look at it, it's quite staggering, because ordinary consumers, when they hear the word social entrepreneur, or ordinary individuals who may be considering going into business, aren't aware of what does social entrepreneurship mean, and how is it different from an ordinary commercial or business enterprise. So let's just begin by answering a few questions. Number one is, what is a social entrepreneur? Let's start with the definition. Now, I must say that in terms of a definition, there isn't a universally accepted definition, but broadly, a social entrepreneur can be described as someone who uses commercial strategies to tackle social and environmental problems. So if you look at it, if I break it down, a social entrepreneur is someone who finds an innovative or very creative way to solve a diverse range of environmental or social problems, but these environmental or social problems are resolved through a business lens. So you'll find it's a very commercial sense or flavor given towards solving a social problem. Maybe I should just give us an example so that the definition relates to people. So let's say you have an issue with crime in a community. And we're looking at solving the problem of crime in a particular community. So you could have an individual who starts out with a security firm, a security company, recruiting a number of security guards and paying them, but obviously levying a fee within the neighborhood for everyone to support his initiative, and obviously to defray his own costs that are incurred in employing 10 or 20 people. So this is a case of or an example of a social entrepreneur where he or she identifies a social problem and alleviates that social problem through a business lens, and in the process there's some benefit or some gain derived in managing that particular enterprise. But so social entrepreneurship is gaining traction globally, as you mentioned correctly, Ray, and that is as far as the definition goes. Now the big question arises, is the person running a business or is that individual in charity? On point, the question is on point, but keep in mind that social entrepreneurs can structure their organizations in different ways. In some cases, that particular social need is fulfilled through a business lens, but using a non-profit structure. Or it could be using a profit-based structure where the individual himself or herself makes a profit and lives their life. If it's structured on a non-profit basis, then basically what happens is any profit that is derived is put back towards the particular cause or social need that they are trying to fulfill and see to. So that's basically, that question will always lurk in the background of whether the individual is actually doing a business or is it a charity. But in the end of the day, if you look at the South African context, we have so much happening, so many social ills. If anyone is able to find a solution to any of the ills that we find ourselves embroiled in, this will be a bonus for us. And if that individual is able to make a living off it, well and good, and good luck to them. Then the issue of do governments support social entrepreneurs? I must add, and this is very interesting for me, we see more nations considering laws to promote social entrepreneurship. This is purely because many governments across the world are not able to fulfill the needs of their citizenry. And as a result, they are encouraging citizens to take up specific social causes which are ordinarily the government's duty and responsibility, but as a result of maybe short tax revenue, whatever it is, or maybe even manpower, the government or many nations across the world are willing to part and shed some of their duties unto ordinary individuals who can manage social enterprises more responsibly. So you'll find many nations implementing legal frameworks which are conducive to supporting social entrepreneurs, tax incentives, maybe even providing funding for businesses. If I just use specific examples, Britain has specific business structures for social enterprises. They offer tax breaks, and this year even expanded its law incentivizing government to buy products and services from ethical businesses. So you have a social enterprise providing a specific good or service, and the government itself is the client paying for these services so that the ethical or the social enterprise can sustain itself and continue. This year we also have the example of Thailand, which implemented a law to give tax breaks to registered social enterprises who commit to reinvesting 70% of their profits. Ireland itself published its first social enterprise policy for social enterprises to help build awareness and even growth. So as you see in these particular examples of Britain, Thailand, Ireland, these countries are some of the leading nations in terms of developing frameworks and support structures for social enterprises. Let me just end off by giving some examples of social enterprises that have succeeded quite well in the world today. I'm not particularly endorsing some of them because I do acknowledge that some of them do involve elements of interest or financial concepts which may be in breach of Sharia law, but in general just accept the fact that some of these social enterprises have succeeded within the conventional framework of what it means to be a social enterprise. The first example is Britain's program called Big Issue. Big Issue is a very interesting social enterprise because it hires homeless people to sell street papers. Just ordinary individuals who don't have a home, suddenly being able to have something to sell off and make money for themselves, fulfilling a specific need of individuals who require a newspaper for the day, for example. India, in India, you have the Barefoot College exercise, also a very successful social enterprise. Barefoot College basically aims to improve life in rural villages around the world by training people with skills in solar engineering, healthcare, and even water testing. Now, if you look at these specific examples, you'll find that healthcare, nursing, water testing, basic bridging finance, or even catering for the needs of homeless or even widows, these are all social problems that plague even our society. And if we can find individuals who can innovate ways to tackle these social problems, you'll find that individuals can even live, make a decent living, and survive, and not only survive, but also thrive based on fulfilling a social need. So you'll find the individual engaged in business, but at the same time, it becomes a very fulfilling exercise because the individual is also contributing towards a larger, bigger picture and a social cause in general. I hope that clarifies what a social entrepreneur is, and I hope that it does whet the appetite of individuals to explore ideas of social ills that plague our society and that can be addressed through social enterprise.